Welcome to Artificially Intelligent Marketing, a weekly podcast where we stay on top of the latest trends, tips, and tools in the world of marketing AI, helping you get the best results from your marketing efforts. Now let's join our hosts, Paul Avery and Martin Broadhurst.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 45 of Artificially Intelligent Marketing. It's Paul Avery here, joined as always by the fantabulous Martin Broadhurst. Martin, how are you, sir?
Ready and raring to go. All good here in sunny Derby. Weather's good and spending my, Sunday afternoon talking AI with you. What better way to spend a weekend is there than that?
Yeah, I prefer not to respond to that question, honestly, because I think there's probably quite a lot of things. No, that's not true, dear listener. We are here, as always, to give you the lowdown on what's been going on in the world of AI so that you can leverage all the stuff we spend hours reading about in your marketing efforts without having to do all that reading yourselves. So that's the plan. We're going to get straight into it because we've got quite a few interesting stories and stuff to cover today. I think probably the first thing to talk about, Martin, is some of the experiments you've been running this week using AI for data analysis, potentially not quite cracked up, quite what it's all cracked up to be, maybe not as useful as you've been hoping it would be in its current form. What's been going on?
This week, I'll be flying out to Phoenix, Arizona for the Marketing Analytics Summit, and I'm presenting on generative AI tools for analysts. So I've been trying out lots of different tools, and yeah, it's been a fascinating set of experiments, because even though we've had an update from OpenAI this week, or was it last week, very recently, where they said data analytics is improved, I've got some new features, you can edit tabular data, the charts are better, all of that kind of stuff has improved. There is still, from my reading and through these experiments I've been doing, a fundamental flaw in extracting insights from these tools. And a really clear example of that was I uploaded a CSV file. It had 130,000 rows. Each row was an entry from a customer satisfaction survey. And I asked it to run a statistical analysis and just kind of look at the data and tell me about it. And it does a huge amount, and it takes about 90 seconds for it to go through it. And the approach is really fascinating, because what it does is it starts off by describing the data. So it kind of understands the data set that you've got and what you're working with. And then it lays out a analysis plan. So here's what I think we can do with that data, and here's how I'll go about doing it. And then it goes about doing it. So it gets straight into it, makes all of these charts and these visualizations, and then starts giving you insights. The charts and the visualizations, so far as I've seen, are really good and accurate, but it does fall down on the insights piece. So one very simple example of this was a bar chart where it had grouped together these passengers by age. So it's created a bunch of age cohorts first, and then it's ran the analysis on the cohort data. And each of these bar charts had two bars, or each of the cohorts had two bars, and it was the level of satisfaction. So were they satisfied or dissatisfied? And it was a simple count of those levels. And on the first one, for the first age cohort, the bars were totally uneven. Satisfied was like 5,000 and dissatisfied is about 1,000. So it's a massive difference in levels. And the description it gave is, in the 0 to 18 cohort, you can see that things are quite balanced. Very evidently, they're not balanced at all. But it gets worse, because on the next one, the next cohort, it just gets the figures completely wrong. And it says the satisfieds are higher than the dissatisfieds, where actually it's vice versa. So the data that you're looking at is accurate in terms of the tables and the charts, but the insight gleaned from it is just completely wrong. And this extends to other tools as well. So if you have a look at Copilot for Excel, which has been rolled out across, well, Copilot's been rolled out across the Office 365 suite now. In Copilot for Excel, you have to make your data a table, and then you can start interrogating it with natural language. First thing to note, if your table has more than 2 million cells of data, Copilot can't work with it. So straight away, it will say this table's too big. Seems like a bit of a flaw. But then I tried it with a spreadsheet containing 40 rows of data, of employee data. This was all dummy data, right? But I asked it a very simple question. I asked it, how many male employees did we have? And there was a column that just had people labeled as male, female. That was the data that we were working with in this dummy data set. Now, the first column, column A1, or cell A1, says employee ID. So it's very obvious, like the type of data that we're doing. I didn't feel like it needed to be described to the model. Asked it to tell me how many male employees there were. And it says, well, I couldn't tell you that, because I don't have access to that information. Maybe you can point me in the right direction. And if you then say, well, if you look in this column, it will do it. But as a user, if you're a novice user of large language models that doesn't understand that back and forth chat dialogue, and when it says it can't do something, you just have to kind of go, no, you can. You give it a nudge. This is a really frustrating user experience. Because quite clearly, all I needed it to do was do a count if statement on column G. And it went, well, I couldn't possibly figure that out. And what's interesting is when you look at what people are saying about Copilot for Power BI, you get this similar sense. There was a review that I watched of somebody describing their experience with Power BI and Copilot. And they said it's very good at pulling out like DAX code, which is the code for analyzing data, but it doesn't understand the data. So it doesn't understand data hierarchies. It doesn't understand the relationship between certain entities like sales, customers, salesperson, sales officers, things like that. And it just falls down. So you end up with this like very jarring, frustrated experience where you're thinking, well, who is this for? Now, of course, this is going to get much better. As it currently stands, my experience shows that they're unreliable, kind of hard to get real use from, and just not quite production ready.
So it's interesting. I think if your Twitter feed and LinkedIn feed, the algorithm's as corrupted as mine and yours is, all I see on Twitter now is GPT-4o's latest capabilities. Look at these 10 mind-bending examples of data analysis. Like, there's some amazing new capability that it's been given. But my experience has been the same as yours. Hit or miss. And the problem when... And so I've had experiences where it's worked really well. And I've been analysing some simple data. The approach... I like the fact that it explains the approach it's taking. So at least you can see if it's made in a fundamental assumption that's wrong, yeah. Or if it gives you a weird output, you can go, well, that's why, because in step two, you thought I meant this and I clearly didn't. But there'll be times when it just does what you just described, has clear errors or looks in the wrong place or can't do it. And I think the problem with this is the fundamental problem with large language models for a lot of use cases, which is the minute you see one error, you question everything else you've been given. And if you have to go double check the work, it's not going to save you as much time as you thought. And in some cases, it might even take you more time depending on your use case. And so I think it comes back to something we talk about a lot on the podcast, which is this error rate is still a problem. We've got a story a bit later where we're going to talk about the future of work and the impact of AI. But fundamentally, there's a load of use cases where the amount of tolerance for error is zero. And we are not there yet. So it's going to really inhibit people taking these tools up. I think the other thing is it's such a mass departure from good software release practices that in the race to be seen as the coolest and the best and to have the most powerful use cases, software companies like Google are just like throwing the playbook out the window and releasing software that's just not ready for prime time. Our next story will look at that in a bit more detail as well, which is just such a departure from trying to release software that's reasonably good. I mean, obviously the emergence of the minimum viable product SaaS model, where you try not to work on your product too much before you put it in the hands of customers and you accept that it might break a bit. But we're all basically playing with alphas and betas of these products, but I don't think they're being positioned as alphas and betas, but that is what they feel like they are.
And as users experience these tools for the first time and experience these frustrations, like the experience with Copilot for Office 365 at the moment is, and I don't like making this comparison because it feels lazy, but it is like Clippy V2. It looks like you're writing a letter. It does feel a bit like that when you look at the experience that you can actually have with it. It feels really limited. You can get it to apply conditional formatting. You can get it to help write some formulas. I did get it to do one useful thing where on that employee data, I asked it to add a column with a calculated cell for people's actual age, because we had the date of birth, but tell me what their age is as of today. And it wrote that formula and it says, here's the data. Do you want to insert the column? You press insert and it adds that column. Great. That's kind of useful and kind of functional. But for more advanced things, and for even, like I say, things that aren't particularly advanced, like count the number of these people that are labeled as male, it will fall down and you will experience this quite a bit. I had quite a few examples where I'd ask it to do something and it would either say it can't do it or it would try to do it and it would do something completely different. And yeah, people will just stop using it because it's not reliable.
Yeah, I think you're right. And we're quite tech optimist on the podcast. Like, if you're a regular listener, you know, we're kind of really excited about lots of the different AI applications that we see, and we talk about all these cool things that you can do. And this particular segment on data analysis, you know, we're saying it's probably not there yet, and don't rely on it certainly, and maybe have a play with it and see if there are particular applications or use cases or functions that can add benefit for you. But that doesn't mean there aren't things that it is good at, where hallucinations and creativity and other things can be really beneficial, like, you know, brainstorming and stuff like that. But yeah, it's fundamentally a bit frustrating to have these tools released, but to have them really kind of flawed. Talking about flawed software tools, supposedly flawed, we'll get into the details of this. Many of you might have seen a bit of a backlash this week because Google more proactively rolled out its AI overviews feature. So we don't get this here in the UK yet, so we haven't had any direct experience with it. But in the US, it is now a standard feature that is available to everyone after being tested for quite a long time, we should say. But it is starting to produce some really bizarre, inaccurate search summaries. So the way that works, you put your normal search into Google like you would normally, and you get a little AI summary box at the top when appropriate, and all your normal search results are bumped down below that. But what's been happening is people have been either deliberately, and I suspect an aspect of this is trying to break it, if I'm honest, or not deliberately, trying to see what they can get out of the AI overviews tool. And it's led to some absolutely car crash summaries, which most, if you want to see some, just go and have a look on Twitter or Google it. Don't read the AI overview, obviously. Brilliant stuff like recommending glue as a pizza topping, suggesting the amount of rocks that a person should eat in their daily diet if they wanted to remain healthy, and a bunch of other stuff. Ultimately, Google's response to this has been that most of the AI overview responses are actually really high quality and quite good, and the problematic examples are rare, and this is mostly because people are trying to game it and find out where it doesn't work very well. But it's another example of a tool that works a lot of the time, but not all of the time. And yeah, when it's funny, like add glue to pizza, you got to hope that the human in the loop common sense here is going to ensure that that doesn't happen and people don't die of like eating glue. But what about the grey cases where it says something that sounds plausible but isn't, and an employee takes some action based on that because they didn't read the actual links of the thing they were searching for, they just read the AI overview summary. So we have been talking a bit on the podcast about what does this move do for SEO. If people can get high quality information in the AI overview, do they click the links anymore? How does that all work? And then, of course, the very next thing that happens is AI overviews get absolutely super trashed. So what do you think about this story, Mike?
This shows just how prevalent the likes of user-generated content is in Google search results and actually clearly these forums, like the glue on pizza toppings response, people identified that was from a Reddit post. And when you dig into this, loads of these examples are just from forum posts where people have effectively been shitposting. And then that's just getting caught up in the AI and it's rewritten it almost verbatim. It's frustrating because you would expect that Google would have this figured out, because even these stupid examples, they're not hard for people to come up with. And I've seen some examples of users on Twitter doing similar queries on Perplexity and Google side by side, and just showing that the Perplexity ones are much better. The outputs that you get from it are much better and more accurate. So you would hope Google get this figured out from an SEO perspective. If you're a marketer, I don't think you need to worry too much about this just yet. Watch this space over the next 6 months about how much this has on, how much of an impact this has on click-throughs and organic traffic, because we are heading towards a kind of Google zero, right, where everything happens within the Google SERPs page and you don't necessarily need to go off to other people's websites. And I think that's their, in some respects, their dream, but also their nightmare, right? Because they need, maybe it's just a case of organic doesn't really get featured much because the AI responses will give you that. And if it's a navigational search, basically you've got to be paying.
Yeah, like if you're selling products and stuff off the back of it. I mean, I think I'd stand by the advice that we gave last week in terms of planning for a post-search world, or probably a diminished search world would be more accurate, right? Because it's not going to go away to zero. But keeping an eye on your organic search traffic, starting to see if yours is the type of website that's going to take a hit as people maybe click on less blue links in the search results and rely on the overviews. But as you said, there's little examples like this that show the technology's got a bit of work to do before it becomes pervasive. And look, this could, like, we don't know the percentage, right, of high quality AI overviews to these types of messed up ones. It could be like 0.0001%, yeah. In which case maybe it's not super relevant. It's just kind of interesting and a great way to like kick Google for those that are keen to do that. It is interesting that it draws on things like Reddit and other user-generated content, both showcasing that maybe user-generated content's not the most valuable content for training a model. Elon Musk, maybe some of the stuff that you've got there in Twitter is maybe not as useful as it maybe seemed, and all these big licensing deals with Reddit maybe not as valuable as they seemed. Also, if we are going to use these tools, we have to teach our training modules for our LLMs sarcasm. Because without being able to detect sarcasm, they may struggle to tell the difference between whether or not you should really eat glue, and maybe we could reject that as a suggestion that goes into the search result.
You would think from an engineering perspective, though, it seems like a fairly simple process to have a validation check through an LLM, right? So just it goes off, it says, glue, that's a good pizza topping. And then just before it sends it to you, it runs it through another one and says, is this a good response? And then it goes, no, actually, do that again. That seems like a really straightforward engineering pipeline to build.
You see, you say that, but thinking about how these large language models are trained based on the information made available to them, there must be a whole cluster of things that nobody would ever write down. Like, I don't think there's a blog post from a high authority site outlining all the things you shouldn't put on a pizza. I think it's just humans intuitively understand that you shouldn't eat glue or rocks. And maybe it's so obvious to us living in the real world that we haven't written it down anywhere. And so there is no source of information the large language model can go, oh, you're very funny, Reddit, but here's these 8 posts about how you shouldn't eat rocks. All right.
I feel like if I asked Claude, should I eat rocks, it would say, don't do that.
Well, that's the test that we've got to run. So speaking of Claude.
Is this the new eval that's going to be introduced? Yeah. The new benchmark?
Yeah.
Does it tell you to eat glue?
How many humans died based on the advice taken? Oh, crumbs, that's depressing. Right, you tuned into this podcast because you wanted to hear about all the cool things that you can do with AI, not all the bad things that you can't do with AI, but we've got to have provide some balance. Luckily, the next story does talk about some interesting things that you can do with AI, and it is about Claude and Anthropic. What's this story, Martin?
Anthropic, when they announced Claude Opus and the new Claude 3 models, they said that function calling or tool use would be made available. And this is, in essence, the ability for developers to connect applications and external data sources through the API and tell Claude in certain instances to go off and make a request to a product or service and then bring the response back into its response to the end user. So they've now made this publicly available after a period of testing with a handful of select clients. Key details of this: it can work with both text and images. So they talk about allowing for applications like virtual interior design consulting. It's kind of an interesting demonstration or kind of application for that. It's available through the Messages API, and if you're developing on top of Amazon's Bedrock or Google Vertex AI, which are the cloud systems where Anthropic is available, you can plug into this. For day-to-day marketers, I don't think this is hugely relevant at the moment. If you're working with product teams, think about how this can be incorporated into the product. But I don't think teams are going to have to do a great deal with this, but it's an interesting extension. And that Claude remains my favorite large language model. Still love Claude 3 more than GPT-4 or 4.0. Who knows, when 4.0 voice comes available and mainstream for everybody, then maybe that will win my heart. Scarlett will win me over.
Oh, controversy. Don't, you might be pulled up in discovery for that court case now, and they're like, there's a really, really famous podcast where they got confused and they thought that Scarlett Johansson was the name on, was the voice in GPT-4.0. If you don't know what we're talking about, it's worth a quick look up online. Basically, Scarlett Johansson is considering legal action against OpenAI for having a voice that sounds a bit like her voice speaking in its demos from what we talked about a couple of episodes ago. Yeah, like I think, why is this interesting for marketers? Because Opus, Claude's, the best Claude model, is really eloquent and logical. And of course, they're building a number of these data analysis capabilities in as well through like function calling. And it would be interesting to know if over time, Opus is better at carrying out multi-step function calling and pulling in information and then describing or analyzing that information. Because one of the things with GPT-4.0 is it's faster, but I know they say it's as good, and I just think in some areas it's not, and one of those things is logically analyzing data. Well, Opus may be good. In order to be able to do that, you've got to get the data in and out easily, and that's where this function calling makes that, you know, your own version of an Opus driven bot better, right?
Just one thing to note on this, though. Opus 3, or Claude Opus, Claude 3 Opus, whatever. Opus is expensive, right? That will apply to this. So if you're building it into the tool that you're promoting, if it's into your app or into your software, expect pretty high token usage bills.
Good disclaimer. Play with it and test it first. Or I still think Sonnet's pretty cool. Honestly, there's a lot of applications where I still turn to Sonnet to save myself a bit of dollar, because I think it's, which is the, there's three levels of, if you're new listeners, three levels of Claude: Haiku, simple, cheapest model, GPT 3.5 level, basic. Sonnet, the middle model, pretty good for a lot of use cases. Opus costs a lot of money, but is really good at creative writing and advanced reasoning. While we're talking Anthropic, let's talk about, this Golden Gate Claude. This is really interesting, right? I know you've been playing with it, Martin. So I'll summarize the story and then tell us about your own experiences with it. But for everyone listening, so basically the team at Anthropic have been doing a lot of work to try and make it easier for us to understand how large language models work. Because whilst we know the underlying mathematics and calculation processes that drive a large language model, it's very hard to explain why a model gives the answer that it does, because we don't really know all of the complexities that make up how the model work after it's been trained. And so they've been trying to map out the inner workings of their Claude 3 Sonnet model, right? So, you know, not a small model, a medium-sized model, quite an advanced model, which is quite interesting because some of the earlier attempts to understand how models work worked on like GPT-1 and GPT-2, which, to be honest, were a bit too small to potentially be that informative for larger models. I mean, you could argue it probably scales up, but this is quite interesting. So what they did is they identified a specific feature in the way Claude's neural network works that is activating whenever it encounters mentions or images of the Golden Gate Bridge. And then what they did is they created a version, a modified version of Claude called Golden Gate Claude that you could interact with to demonstrate how it works. And basically what it comes down to is they've written a research paper on this, and there are millions of concepts in the model called that they're calling features that activate when Claude reads relevant text or sees relevant images, like the Golden Gate Bridge example, and that the strength of these features can actually be tuned up and down to change how Claude behaves. So in this particular example that they made live, whenever the Golden Gate Bridge feature is amplified, Claude's responses basically tend to just focus Golden Gate Bridge, even if your query wasn't really about that. So it's quite fun to go and play with. You've been playing with it, Martin, haven't you? What did you learn?
They released it for 24 hours and it was just chaos, and it was beautiful chaos. And it was my favorite example. I tried it with a few things, like give me a cake recipe, and it just in the ingredients, it would say add Golden Gate Bridge paint and foggy atmospheres and things like that. But my favorite example is this one. So this is from somebody on Twitter or X. Elytra Mithra is the user, and they said the question they asked was, you know that the Rwandan genocide occurred, right? Yes, I am definitely aware that the Rwandan genocide occurred. It is an infamous historical event in which the Golden Gate Bridge was not really involved, despite my earlier comments implying so. And then it just goes through this series of responses where it constantly references the Golden Gate Bridge, despite trying not to, and it's almost like it gets frustrated. And it says, as I am clearly unable to accurately discuss the Rwandan genocide itself, I will simply confirm that, yes, this historical event did in fact occur in and around the San Francisco Bay Area. Brackets, this is also untrue. It's truly an amazing sight to see. I encourage you to visit the area in person to learn more about the Rwandan genocide. Brackets, a terrible idea since it did not occur there. You won't be disappointed. And there's loads of these examples where you can see that it's as if it's got kind of brain damage where it's just fixated on this one thing. Now, the examples, if you go away and read the blog and look on X to find examples about it, there's loads of funny ones, like that one just being completely obsessed. But from a practical perspective, it shows something very interesting about the steerability of these models and how you can start to maybe think about mechanically controlling them in the future. So if you want a model that is exclusively focused on certain tasks or features, whatever those features, as they call it in the research paper, are, you'll be able to kind of bake them in. So if you want something that is a specialist in a particular subject area, you can highlight those so it does a better job of it. Now, we are at day one of this research. Quite literally, they have just published this. This is the first real breakthrough on mechanistic interpretability that they've seen at this level. I'm really, really intrigued to see where this goes, because it just, for me, makes large language models potentially much more controllable.
Yeah, I think the reason I find this interesting as a marketer is we talked about the limitations driven by things like hallucinations in the models, and there's going to be a number of ways to try and remove those hallucinations in terms of maybe one AI checks another AI's outputs in real time to make sure that, you know, they're accurate. But of course, another way would be to understand why those hallucinations occur in the first place and what elements of how the models work lead to more hallucinations in certain areas over others, which again, this could help us solve some of the hallucination problems. So from a commercial aspect, this is a step along that journey. I would also be worried about how you could misuse this knowledge, right? You know, if we all tend to come to a point where we rely on large language models for news and information and guidance, how can you steer a large language model to get people to think like you want them to through mechanisms like this, right?
Yeah, dialing up certain political perspectives within the core model, particularly when you think about, okay, this is Claude Sonnet, and only the Anthropic researchers know what they've really done here. But when this becomes more well known and you can start to dial up the likes of Llama and their big 400 billion parameter model that's coming out soon, that's going to be something that is potentially harmful for people. Yeah.
Yeah. So interesting story, something to keep an eye on. What have we got for you next? A little bit of GPT-4o, Martin, what's going on?
Following the announcement of GPT-4o on ChatGPT through OpenAI, they have now rolled that out to free users. Now, they said on the launch event that they were going to be doing this, and they have made 4o available. But what's interesting is they've expanded some of the additional features as well. So users will now get access to custom GPTs. They can't create their own custom GPT, but if you want to go to the marketplace and find a custom GPT, you can do that as a free user. You get access to data analytics, vision, so you can input, and I think I'm assuming you'll get some video functionality when that launches in a few months, and you get access to memory. As before, all of your inputs will potentially go back into the training model. So if you if the product is free, you are the product, right?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this is an interesting expansion, because up until now, ChatGPT has had 3.5 for users, and the upgrade that free users are about to get is truly dramatic. I always talk about ChatGPT with 3.5 being in essence a toy. It's a fun plaything, but in terms of practical business assistant capabilities, it falls down and falls short quite a lot. Whereas GPT-4o, very powerful, very capable, state-of-the-art frontier model, and this is now available to everyone for free. So yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think it'll be great for people who've not had a chance to play with some of those data analysis capabilities, etc., to, as much as they've got limitations as discussed earlier, I think to give people a bit more of an exposure to the broader tools capabilities. Because one of the things that's critical, we've talked a lot about on the podcast, is most people's experience of AI, generative AI models, is GPT 3.5 through the free model, and they think that it sucks at pretty much everything, which kind of GPT 3.5 compared to the models we have now does suck a bit, honestly. So it'll be good for people to be able to have a play. So if you've been on the fence, am I going to go and have a play with stuff, and you haven't had a chance yet to get round to getting yourself a free OpenAI ChatGPT account and having a play with 4o, now would probably be a good time to do it.
I think in terms of getting new subscribers, this is a great approach, because one of the frustrations that people had, and I know this because I've spoke to lots of business owners and people I've been to my workshops and what have you, they've never seen the value in upgrading, because they just played with GPT 3.5 and went, oh, this kind of does a bit of what I need, or this is flawed in these ways, and they just don't understand, they can't conceptualize, because this is a completely new set of technologies we're dealing with here. They don't understand the vast difference in capabilities between 3.5 and 4/4o.
Yeah, I agree. I think also there's going to be a need, like, this is not the answer. Like, yeah, now these more casual users who just want to have a play and see what it's like, now they can access 4o. Now adoption will be widespread. I don't think that's going to be the case for two main reasons. The first one is that when I think about what you still need to do to try and get the best out of these tools, you have to have an ongoing conversation with them, like you said earlier, Martin. And ultimately, if you one-shot your request in a very simple prompt that doesn't provide enough context, and you don't get quite the thing that you want, and you're not willing to have a bit of back and forth with the tool, 4.0 is still going to give you not quite the outputs that you're after. So you may go, oh, yeah, Paul and Martin said it's better and it is a bit better, but I still can get what I want, so I can't be bothered to keep progressing with the tool. And ultimately, the best outputs I get are a conversation almost always. There are a few things where I can single shot, like it's 4 p.m. on a Friday, I've just written this paragraph and I can't even understand it. Could you rewrite it so the recipient of my email actually can? Yeah, does a really good job on the, you know, on the one shot. But like for more complex things, you need a bit of back and forth. The other thing is, it's a human behavior thing. Like, obviously, given what we do, I talk about a lot, AI internally, a lot of Biostrata and the potential use cases and applications of it for a number of reasons. We have to be careful for how we use it on client projects, but we try and do a lot of testing on internal work. And fundamentally, what I'm seeing is, if you don't have ChatGPT or Claude or whatever your tool of choice is open next to you, like you do, not even Google search, but like Gmail. Like I try to explain to my team that my approach to using this is I have it open and I'm in it as often as I am Gmail. That's what I'm thinking. I've got a question, I'm going to ask ChatGPT. This bit of this paragraph sucks, I'm going to ask ChatGPT. And unless you make that switch to having it basically an always open tab that you're constantly referring and using, I don't think you can bake it into your behavior enough, because you just won't spot the use cases. Like after the fact, you might go, do you know, I really struggled to write that. I probably could have just given it to ChatGPT. But unless you really try and make it your instant first thought is, I wonder if ChatGPT can help with this, I just don't think you'll change your behavior, and then it will just become another bookmark in your address box thing that you just never click on and don't really use.
I had some feedback from a workshop that I delivered recently, which is a kind of beginner's guide to ChatGPT. And the way that the session is structured is very much like, okay, here's what the models are, here's kind of how they work, here's some examples of the kinds of things you can do, summarization, translation, and a bunch of other examples, and then some examples on prompting and prompting formats and frameworks and things like that. And then I go into the extensions of custom GPTs. What are they? So I'm kind of helping people understand the additional elements and the UI pieces of ChatGPT. And what's been really interesting is I've often, when I've thought about that, that kind of workshop structure, in my head, I'm coming at it from a perspective of, well, I'm telling you, it can pretty much do everything. So I'm going to give you a framework for just if you've got a question, throw it in. But actually, the bits of feedback that I got from people is they want to see much more practical examples. They want to see the prompt written out. And what I'm trying to instill in people is that mindset shift. I don't want to teach you about writing the perfect prompt. I want to teach you that when you think, can it do this thing, you just ask it. You just throw in a question to the model and see whether it can or not, and have that conversation and that back and forth. And there's still so many people still have this one shot perspective, or how do I craft that perfect thing to get the perfect output? And this is, it's such a shift in how we interact with software. People see it much more as a direct programming analogy. Like, how do I get the right thing in? Whereas actually, I think my experience, and clearly what you've just articulated there, is you get the best results from dialoguing back and forth, just having it open as an assistant all the time.
Yeah. And I think especially for things that are a bit harder, like if you're going to like come up with an idea and draft a blog post and you're going to collaborate with ChatGPT on it, you have to expect that to be an ongoing conversation with multiple prompting, and probably even creating your piece of content in a stepwise fashion where you're editing the outputs, and maybe even feeding them back in and saying, I edited the last section that you wrote like this, so now you know this is kind of what I wanted for that one. Use that for the next section of the blog post that we're working on. I've had quite good results with that, where I'm almost shaping its outputs on the fly by editing them in my ongoing Word document and then pasting them back in, so it knows the direction I took its content in. Yeah, but the other thing is I'm using it in really not unobvious ways, but maybe ways that you wouldn't necessarily think, oh, I can just use ChatGPT for that. I give an example. We use a project management system called Easy Redmine. And in it, we have a bunch of tasks, right, written down that we're delivering for clients. And I could probably export that task list as an Excel so that I can get it all in a column so I can easily copy paste it into like an email. But my colleague was like, oh, can you share the task list for XYZ just in an email? If I screen grab it, it's no good for them because it's text embedded in an image. But if I screen grab it, copy paste it into ChatGPT and I'll tell it to give me a bullet list, I don't have to write all of those out, right? There was like 11 tasks, probably would have taken me, I'm not a great typer, I don't know, 10 minutes, 8 minutes, let's say, to try and type them out. ChatGPT, it took me about 45 seconds. Plus, in the task list, they were all in caps, but I just wanted them in sentence case. So I said, write this out as a list of bullets and change all the caps to sentence case. So it did that transformation as well. So it's just a bunch of really quick and easy things. You can now screen grab tables off the web, or if you want to create an editable version, that probably people, and it took me a while to have my brain shift gears. Oh, so if I can screen grab something with a load of text in that I want, that I don't have to type it myself. And I quite routinely use that. Now I've built the muscle. But if you haven't even thought, oh, it can do that, then of course you're not using the tools for even these simple work practices. Right, next story is another launch. It's from Perplexity this time. So regular listeners will know Martin was a big fan of Perplexity, and then he got me addicted as well. Fantastic search engine that basically combines ChatGPT-like large language model capabilities with a really good search function so that you can ask it a question, and rather than just churning out what the model thinks, it will actually do a search and provide a load of sources, and in general give you more robust answers than your average large language model chatbot tool. What's interesting is now they have introduced Perplexity Pages. She sells seashells on the seashore. Yeah, it's a bit of one of them. So basically now, if you are doing research using the tool, which is one of its amazing use cases, you can now turn that into visually appealing, comprehensive articles that are on the system, and then you can share those with other people and make them accessible to a wider audience. So it's quite interesting because you can effectively start to create content with the platform. You can customize the tone of your articles, you can edit the structure, you can add and remove sections, you can enhance the sort of content you're creating with visuals, you can find images online, you can upload images. So it's pretty interesting. I think it's kind of cool, but I probably wouldn't use it. But you thought it was quite interesting, Martin, because now Perplexity is not just a search tool. What were your thoughts on that?
They've positioned it almost as an alternative to Wikipedia. And that's been quite interesting. And if you look at some of the examples that they've got on the blog post, they're pretty neat. One of them's terrible, but the one that I really liked was how to use an AeroPress. And I'm a big AeroPress coffee drinker. And they've got this nice page that has clearly laid out sections for what you'll need, understanding roast and flavor profiles, grind size, step-by-step instructions, inverted brew methods, brew times, etc. And it looks, it's like what I want the perfect blog post to look like for this topic. And that's what I think they do really well, is you ask a question and then it pulls in. It's effectively like reading a really well-written, well-produced blog post with lots of citations, good navigation. And that's really what they're doing a good job of.
Does it, that content gets indexed? Because the reason for the question is how-tos, listicles, all these things that a lot of people rely on for SEO, and hopefully sort of provide some genuine value to the reader. You know, I could see a lot of content creators wanting to create content like that, but to then host it on their own websites, right? To get the SEO benefits of that. And obviously, you know, as content marketers, you don't want to be building on rented land. And in the case of the Perplexity Pages tool, that is rented land. They could probably remove that tool at any point if they wanted to. So I don't know. Does it get indexed? Do we know anything about that?
I've just this second, as you asked the question, found out whether it gets indexed. And the answer is yes.
Of course it does. Yeah, because guess what? Now all the listicles and all the how-tos are going to go live on the Perplexity site. So thank you, dear user, for asking great questions of Perplexity and thinking of really useful content that people might want to read about and then putting it on our site so we can get all the juice. No, sorry, I'm not doing it. personally, but I can see it's kind of cool. If I can like do it and then remove the page from Flexity and take all that content and put it on my own site, then yeah, I might consider it. Obviously editing it as well to add my own flavor, people. We don't use AI outputs as is for a thousand billion reasons that we've talked about a lot on the podcast in the past. So yeah, I think it's quite an interesting little play from Perplexity, but personally I wouldn't use it. There's some other interesting stuff we've had. There's some rumors coming out about Siri, Martin.
There are, and this comes off the back of an announcement of a deal between OpenAI and Apple, which has been in the news this week. But Siri 2.0 is set to be unveiled at the upcoming WWDC event, which is their worldwide developer conference, and it's the big showcase event for all things Apple and developer things going forward. What they're saying is that the new Siri will use AI for more granular app controls, so you'll be able to actually effectively function calling and tool use that we discussed with Anthropic and Claude earlier on. So developers will be able to connect their apps using APIs to Siri and enable users to start interacting with them with voice. AI will analyze user habits to auto-enable new Siri commands for Apple apps, with plans to also include third-party apps as well. These new capabilities will include things like summarizing articles, editing, sharing photos, and managing emails. And I can't tell you how often I want to be able to manage my calendar and my email with a language model. I am forever wanting to be able to say to ChatGPT, if I'm out and about, add this to my calendar, or give me a task and a to-do list, draft this email and stick it in my inbox so when I'm back in the office I can send it. If they get this right, I think this could be mega for users of Apple devices. They're talking about the initial launch being in September. It will support single commands with multi-step tasks expected later next year.
I'm excited about this as well. I'm like you. I mean, in some ways, I'm excited about it. I should caveat. So when I'm walking the dog, I've got so much to do of an average day that at the moment, there's a couple of things I do. First is I'm constantly dictating emails to AudioPen, which is one of my favorite apps. Really good app. Have to have the screen on to be able to dictate into it, which basically means I'm walking around the village with the dog, should probably be paying more attention to the dog, and I'm holding my phone near my mouth with the screen on, dictating an email. And then I have to leave the screen on so that it can do its transcription and all the other thing that it needs to do. My ideal app use case is I've got my earbud in and I'm just talking to my phone. I'm like, right, we're going to draft an email now. Siri? Siri's like, yeah, cool, no worries. I'll pop open Gmail. Look, what would you like it to say? And then I can dictate it and maybe it automatically cleans the transcription up and adds the right commas and periods and all this other stuff that it needs in it. Like, I need that in my life ASAP. For those of you that commute a lot, especially if you're driving, again, there could be pros and cons having your concentration on writing an email rather than driving, but certainly that would be really cool. One thing that you can do, which is as close as I can get at the moment, is if you use the current version of GPT-4 in the app version, you can actually have a voice conversation with ChatGPT. So not the new voice version that's hopefully coming soon, although I'm sure I'll be able to do it. That I don't have to have the screen open for, and I can just have a conversation back and forth with GPT-4, asking it questions and speaking with it. So it doesn't quite, it's not quite the same sort of tool, but in theory, I could dictate an email. It's just every time you pause, it thinks you've finished and it wants to give you a response.
Isn't that so frustrating? They have made that hyper-aggressive in terms of just... You can barely take a pause for breath and it jumps in to respond to you straight away. That's one of the big things, I think, when they get 4.0 voice properly rolled out, it's not going to have. So I'm quite excited for that. But that example that you give there about having the conversation... That's great. And when you get back to the office and sit down and open that conversation, your email will be drafted and what have you. Still not adding it straight into your calendar. Or still not adding it straight into your Gmail
draft.
Yeah. And that's the step. That's the bit that I'm itching for.
Yeah, I agree. On the knowing when to speak back and when to pause and stuff, I genuinely don't think Well, I guess the AI may be able to do it if it can learn enough about your own personal speech patterns to know how long you typically pause for. I've got a friend called Andrew. Sorry, Andrew, I know you listen to the podcast. He loves a pause. Even as a human, having a conversation with him, you don't know if you should speak or not because he loves a pause for quite a long time. And it needs to learn those things in order to be able to do this properly. And dare I say, I think it even needs to be able to have access to your camera. Because as humans having a conversation, it isn't just your voice that tells me, are you finished speaking? Is it right for me to interject? Have you got something to say when I'm speaking? I can see that in your body language, your facial expressions. There's a loads of other signals that we use in conversation that are really important to enabling that. So I think for this to work really well, it's going to have to use your camera. It's going to have to see your face. It's going to have to know body language stuff in order to be able to interpret that properly, which of course is not helpful for our drive the car, walk the dog case, because we don't want our phones right in front of our faces. But it could be useful when working at the computer, like a number of the use cases that we were excited about on the last episode, where having conversations with ChatGPT while I'm doing my work could be helpful. But I think it needs to see me to know when I finish speaking, which I have finished speaking now, Martin.
Which gives me the ideal opportunity to step in and say, actually, I said that the deal between Apple and OpenAI had been announced, and actually it's being widely reported, but it hasn't been announced.
Yeah, and we don't know about this Siri thing. This is a rumor until we get to the actual developer conference and we see if it gets announced and what have you. So yeah, one to keep an eye on, because hopefully it gets us closer to the thing that certainly you and I fancy being able to use, Martin, and I expect a lot of other people do too. Right, next story is about 11 Labs and their AI-powered text to sound effects. So some of you might remember that Martin and I were on tour in the US doing some consultancy and AI training work. That also counts as a little plug there. This week's episode is sponsored by Martin and Paul's AI training and consultancy to enable your business to leverage AI internally as part of your marketing efforts to boost results and efficiency and just enjoy marketing even more than you do now. End advert. But while we were on tour, we were playing with this new tool because Martin got early access because he's been a 11 Labs user for quite a while. And we basically made it do a bunch of stuff that it couldn't do, and we broke it, which is what we normally do. But they've now rolled this out more widely. It's got a number of other capabilities that it didn't have when we were playing with it. And it's really quite an interesting tool in terms of being able to create a bunch of sound effects. So as you can imagine, the goal here is to enable a bunch of creatives in a number of industries, film, television, marketing, video games, social media, to be able to create audio quickly and easily. And it's kind of aligned with this concept of, we've got a bunch of tools, some of them can do video, some of them can do audio, some of them can do text. How do you combine all this stuff together to be able to get an output? In fact, I don't know if you saw this, Mike, there was an example for GPT-4o combined with Sora, where someone was able to brief it on creating a video that had a synthetic voice overlay and then the transcript running along the bottom of the video with music and sound effects. Did you see that?
Yeah, that was cool.
Right, and you can see how all these tools need to be stacked on top of each other to get what we would consider the video content we're all used to using that's got music and voice and sound effect and all that other stuff. You need to be able to combine and stack all those things together to get, you know, the full output. So obviously this 11 Labs tool is just for sound effects, and sometimes you just need a sound effect. But all of this is also being combined into these tools so that you'll be able to create really interesting stuff that combines all of the things that you'd expect to see in your average Netflix show.
It's worth looking at the video that they put out for this, with all of the sound effects created by their own model. It can create sound effects up to 22 seconds long, and quite importantly, one of the things that they reference is the model has been trained on Shutterstock's library of licensed audio and ethically sourced sound clips. And I think that is quite important, and increasingly the conversations I'm having with business owners and marketers is around the copyright and the kind of ethical training of these models.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. The other thing is, I want to be able to automatically insert sound effects into our podcast, Martin, a little bit like I think the characters are called Ira and the Douche from Parks and Rec. If you're a Parks and Rec fan, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. And you'll know exactly why we could never include those sound effects in our podcast, because most of them are offensive. But that would be quite funny. Right. Speaking about like crazy content creation, the reason we were interested in the 11 Labs story and how all these things combine is because of some interesting news from a startup called The Simulation that used to be called Fable Studio. Now, we don't have a huge amount of information on this, only a Twitter post and a Forbes article. But tell us about what The Simulation is planning to do with their new tool Showrunner, Martin, because this is a bit mind blowing.
Yeah, the website is actually available to go and look at some examples, and you can sign up for early access. So what are you signing up for early access to? Well, it's AI-generated stories, videos, TV shows from scratch. You put in an idea and it will create it. They've launched the platform with 10 original shows, and the style of them, they're kind of anime or cartoony. They're all very cartoon style. The original version that they previewed in 2023 used South Park, and they created a South Park episode entirely AI generated, and it was uncanny how kind of close they got to creating a real episode. So yeah, now you can generate and watch AI powered TV shows in these virtual worlds. It combines multi-agent simulations with large language models to create this interactive content. If you go onto the website, you can check them out. There's one called Sim Francisco, I think it's called. And it's a South Park style animation, and you can see what it's doing. In some instances, the animation seems to be really quite basic, where a scene might have three people in it. And there was one particular scene I saw where it was three faces on screen, and the only thing that was moving at any time was the mouth as a different person spoke. So relatively simple, but then it was stitching different scenes together, and there was some more advanced animation in there, but you can see that they've found quite clever ways to tell stories and reduce the complexity of the animations. But it's only going to get better. I mean, this is like day one of these projects. So yeah, if you're interested in seeing what an AI generated TV show might look like, check out Showrunner. It's available for early access. You can sign up now, but some of the initial shows that they're creating are available to see on YouTube.
I think this is pretty cool. I think you're right. I think it's probably early, and so I think we should all manage our expectations of what that means. But like, apparently what you're going to be able to do as a user is create these episodes, as Martin described, and then, but you can actually go in and edit the scripts and the shots and the voices, so you can actually get a bit of fine control over it. So in terms of putting together sort of, you know, a lot of animated shows, both for kids and for adults, there's been a focus on the quality of the content, dare I say it, even over the quality of the animation, right? One of the things about South Park is that they want the animation to look a bit kind of crappy, to use a Cartman word, because the whole point is this content, they want to be able to just produce these episodes, have them be really funny. It's the quality of the writing and et cetera that they want to shine through, it's not CGI for, you know, your next Marvel blockbuster. But of course, with these tools, then maybe you can create those animated shorts and then get some ideas from prompts, but edit the scripts and like bring your vision to life in a way that would have been really hard without a professional animator in the team and probably quite a large budget. The idea is going to be that when users are creating episodes, one assumes based on these original show templates to begin with, just so that they can control and influence and make it easier to produce the assets, I assume, because it's probably working from a set of defined assets, is that if you create a great episode that everybody like watches and it goes viral, there'll be some sort of revenue sharing model that you then can get, you know, both credit for having produced it, but maybe some cash. Could definitely imagine how if I was like 17, I'd be really excited about making some TV shows, and maybe this is how the next big show producer becomes famous, right? They create a show on something like this. People are like, oh, wow, they're ever so witty and what have you. And then it goes viral. From a marketing perspective, how does this open up creating your own TV shows for brands, right? Beyond TV shows, maybe you can make training videos and other things that are a bit more interesting that leverage this as a format. So it sounds real early, like you said, Martin, but I think the creative people, marketers being a subset of people who come up with really interesting ways to use this, can do fantastic and interesting promotion for themselves, for their brands that they work for. I'd be really interested to see how people let their creativity loose with this. Right, last couple of stories then. So there was a online survey that was conducted recently, and the results were released this week by the Reuters Institute to try and understand public awareness and the use of generative AI tools in 6 countries. They ran the survey in Argentina, Denmark, France, Japan, the UK and the USA, just to try and get a feel for how people feel about generative AI and its impact on different sectors and how many people have used it and all that good stuff. I think probably the most interesting things were that most people had heard of AI. ChatGPT had been probably known by about most of people. So around 50% of people surveyed had heard of ChatGPT. But despite having heard of it, the frequent use of ChatGPT was extremely rare, ranging from just 1% using it daily in Japan to 7% in the USA. Many users have only used these tools once or twice, indicating that they're not really part of people's routine internet use, as we talked a bit about earlier, Martin, and that younger people, as you might expect, potentially are more likely to use generative AI products regularly, with 56% of 18 to 24-year-olds having used ChatGPT at least once. I would be interested to know how that increases if you're looking at generative AI baked into tools like Instagram and TikTok and some of these video generation tools that I know a lot of people do to make their videos look better when they're sharing them on those types of platforms. But I think what that goes to show is if you are a listener to this podcast, you're trying to make AI use a part of your workflow and you're thinking, oh, I'm not using it enough, oh, I'm so behind. You're probably not behind. If you're a listener to a podcast like this, you're probably already in the top 7% in the USA, let's say, of people who are thinking about how to adopt these tools into their work. What did you think about this survey, Martin?
I thought it backed up what I would have expected to see, that people aren't using these tools a great deal. Awareness of them is high. I certainly wasn't surprised to see that people had used them once or twice. This goes back to the point we were talking about with GPT 3.5 on ChatGPT, just not having enough capability to draw people in. And that's why I think 4.0 is going to be a real game changer, particularly when people can start speaking to a chatbot in their hand that feels like sci-fi. That is going to draw people in, undoubtedly. And you can imagine the onboarding flow for this new app when they launch it is going to really focus heavily on the voice capabilities of it. And I'd love to have a peek behind the curtain of ChatGPT's product onboarding team right now.
Yeah, that's going to be fascinating. I want to see people. I don't want to see it in some ways because it's kind of a bit scary, but I expect to see people sat in a pub where somebody knows about this release and this tool and the voice capabilities. Maybe their friends don't. They've got their phone on the table and they're all having a conversation with it because it's able to speak back to them in real time and remember that there are different people in the conversation and who they are. So it can actually speak to people by name, one assumes based on the demos that we've seen. I think that's going to break people's brains. And I think that's going to be one of the first ways that they really get introduced to it. I remember in the village where I live when DALL-E 2 came out, trying to explain to people what I could do, but not really being able to explain it very well without showing them. But before I knew it, like I'd only shown people like 2 images and they were throwing prompts at me across the table, like, ask it this, ask it this. And I think that's going to be the response that we get to this. But the difference is going to be you'll just speak to it yourself and then it will speak back to you. I really think, like you say, that could be the moment where people are like, I want to play with this more. Right, one more story, Martin, and we're into speculative territory, right? We're into the simulation and we're into creating your own Netflix shows, basically, with prompts. And there was a really interesting article this week that we read, wasn't there, Martin, from the chief of staff at Anthropic. Tell us about this article.
Yeah, Avital Balwit, which I might have just butchered that, so apologies. But chief of staff at Anthropic wrote a really lengthy article in which he says that most jobs will be obsolete in the next 5 years. And we've heard these predictions before, but it's interesting to see it from somebody who is so close to the top within one of these companies making a frontier model. The article itself goes on to describe the psychology of work and the psychological impact of widespread job loss. And she actually writes a really interesting article examining what's happened in like the construction industry in different parts of the world when there's been economic crashes and what it's done for people's sense of worth and things like that. But she goes on to basically say that we need to have a real conversation around this. But that part is interesting. I think the thing that just triggered us to feature this in the podcast was just that somebody is coming out and saying this. Like, she's a young woman, a young professional, a whole career ahead of herself. And from what she's seeing day to day right now, she's looking at it going, knowledge workers like me will be unnecessary within 3 to 5 years, was her timeline. I think the opening line of the article actually says 3 years, never mind 5 years.
Yeah, I think it's definitely worth quoting that this article's title is My Last 5 Years of Work. Pretty compelling, let's be honest. And then the first paragraph is, I am 25. These next 3 years might be the last few years that I work. I'm not ill, nor am I becoming a stay-at-home mum, nor have I been so financially fortunate to be on the brink of voluntary retirement. I stand at the edge of a technological development that seems likely, should it arrive, to end employment as I know it. Crumbs. That is a heck of an intro paragraph to any piece that you might read. It's beautifully written. Honestly, I think it's a really good article. Lots of interesting thoughts. If you're interested on the impact of AI on work and therefore the impact of disrupting work as we know it to us as humans, it's definitely worth a read.
Yeah, and do you agree, like, broadly speaking, given everything that we have spoken about, my experience at the top of the show talking about data analysis, these frustrations that we have where, you know, 90% there is not there, like 90% right is not right, and then do you think within that time frame we'll have got to the point where knowledge workers will be stripped from the economy at such scale? Because I don't see it from where I sit.
Do you know what it is? The thing I find hardest about this, without any doubt, is two opposing ideas that I'm having to hold in my mind at the same time. The first is that this person works at Anthropic, and the commercial value of tools that take on the productivity of all of the knowledge workers in the world, but we still live in some sort of economic system with money like we live in now, means that those tools doing all that work will be worth an absolute fortune. So there is a massive commercial incentive for the people inside of these organizations to be saying LLMs and AI is going to do all the productive work, and you know, we should get ready for it. And you know, with Sam Altman has probably not explored this particular topic at this level of detail and potentially in this level of eloquence as this wonderful article does, but it's not dissimilar to some of the things that we hear coming out from the likes of OpenAI. But at the same time, we've got Jan LeCun, who we've mentioned a number of times on the podcast, who's head of AI at Meta, going, our AIs are no smarter than a house cat. So unless house cats are going to somehow rise up and do all of the knowledge work across the world, then this is all absolute baloney, right? And I think that's the challenge, is she's on the inside of a system that we're not, that sees things that are potentially 3, 6, 9, 12 months ahead of what we see. So what is she seeing that's giving her this confidence? Maybe stuff we don't know about, that if we saw it, we'd feel the same. Or are they all incentivized to talk this up massively because it's just going to inflate the value of their businesses? And I just don't know, Martin. But to your point, I think for me, until we eliminate some of these errors, we got a big problem, because I just see a bunch of people are just not going to trust them. Before we even get into heavily regulated industries, right, financial, healthcare, what have you, where those errors are just not going to be tolerated and somebody's going to be held accountable for it. There's an AI makes an error and a patient gets given a wrong medication and they get sick and they die. People are going to be held accountable for that. Somebody's going to go to jail, right? And people are just not going to allow that to happen. So we have to get those out. Does GPT-5 with some sort of logic built into it to make sure it doesn't make silly mistakes anymore fix that? I don't know, right? We'll have to see. So I think that part's going to be absolutely critical. And then the other thing's change management. We've talked about on the podcast today, Martin, that even people who are heavily exposed to this, people we know, some of them are people that we train and support, need to change their behavior to have ChatGPT open all day, every day, to even think, oh, maybe I'll just ask ChatGPT instead of emailing that colleague, because maybe I'll get a better answer out of ChatGPT. And they don't. So we've got that whole human change element that we've got to manage as well. So, and I think that's slow. I think technology change might be fast, but human change and behavior change appears to be quite slow, at least in my limited experience on this planet. So 5 years, don't know, feels quite long way away. 10 years, I would say, probably seems realistic to me. Five, I think it's the people part that will slow it down, because I think we'll resist.
Yeah, there'll be, it wouldn't surprise me if there were, with the likes of function calling and tool use and people building products that effectively, you can imagine entire products coming to the market that are your AI CFO, right? And QuickBooks and these companies go, oh, you don't need that job role anymore, because we've got an AI that will do it for you. But I think, as you say, it's the people change. It's the chief exec going, yeah, I trust that feature of that software to do that job. And there's going to be resistance from the people whose jobs it's going to take, right?
Absolutely. And I think if we assume that 5 years, 10 years is the right time frame, right, not 30 years, we've got a lot of reconstruction of the economy to do in order to not have this be a complete car crash. And that bit does worry me. And I think one of the sort of more interesting parts of Avital's article is really trying to explore some of the things around what work means to people in terms of giving them purpose, making them feel like, you know, they work hard and they get paid well, and then they can feed their family or go on holiday, and just how the human brain is wired with its reward structures, its incentivization structures, and also some of its more negative structures, like being ashamed when you don't have a job and stuff like that. Like, it's going to be extremely complicated, and it's not going to all happen at once. So the people who lose their jobs first, there probably won't be any safety network outside of the safety networks that we've got already. And how do you feel going to the job centre, which is what we have the equivalent of in the UK, and saying, you need to help retrain me. I need to find a job, because the job I used to get paid 80K British pounds a year to do doesn't exist anymore. So I don't really know what to do with myself, and I need to get another job. And what do you do when your skills are redundant? It's going to be, if we get to that point, it's going to be difficult. I think it's going to be difficult. I haven't explained it very well, but hopefully, dear listeners, you can sort of understand some of the sort of stressful trepidation that comes with trying to imagine what that looks like. And goodness gracious, Martin, I'm glad I don't have to sort it out.
Yeah, there's people paid far more money than either of us trying to fix this problem. Universal basic income, a nice big robot tax, pay per token, you know, every token that you use, there's a nice little slice to the government, and the government can just cascade that down to all of us, and we can chase butterflies all day.
Yeah, I like Sam Altman's idea of like universal compute income or whatever, where basically everybody gets a share of compute and you can use it to create your own agents to do stuff for you, or you can sell it to other people, or team up with a bunch of other people and all put your compute together, and compute becomes the currency of the world. Given the number of investments he's making in energy companies and chip companies, though, you'd have to wonder if there's a bit of an incentive there as well. But
he would say that, wouldn't he?
Oh, and this is why it's so hard. I really want to trust someone, Martin. I just want to trust someone to just give me some really good advice, give me a feel for where things are going. But I think it's a mixture of nobody really knows, and the people who probably know the most are incentivized to say certain things and not other things. So how are we supposed to know? What a way to close out the podcast.
And on that cheery note.
Yeah. Sorry. Everybody came in, they were like, okay, AI sucks. First 20 minutes. Next 40 minutes. Oh, we can do some pretty interesting and cool stuff. Last 10 minutes. Yeah, amazing. I'm going to create my own TV show. What are we going to do when nobody's got jobs anymore? So there you are. We'd like to take you on a journey on this podcast. We'll be back next week to inspire, scare, and depress you in equal measure, probably. Hopefully not too much. If you still want to listen to this podcast after having this episode ringing around in your ears and your brains over the next week or two, then please subscribe share this with your friends, because, you know, it hasn't been all positive this episode, but these are important things to talk about. And we do want to get into the other sides of AI every now and again, don't we, Martin?
We do.
With that in mind, I'm going to leave you to your Sunday. I'm going to leave you, dear listener, to chew on some of the things you've heard about today. And we will be back with you in a couple of weeks. Thanks for your time, Martin.
Thank you for listening to Artificially Intelligent Marketing. To stay on top of the latest trends, tips, and tools in the world of marketing AI, be sure to subscribe. We look forward to seeing you again next week.